Well, thank you, Paul, and thank you for the organizing committee. It's a pleasure to be invited to come and talk to you. I am going to be talking, as the title says, about laboratory earthquakes. I'm a laboratory person, so I know a little bit about earthquakes and a lot about the laboratory. And the subtitle there is sometimes what happens in the lab doesn't stay in the lab. That's a little different than what I originally suggested. And in a way, it reflects where things are in the lab today. It's a very exciting time that in the past, I think seismologists as a group were somewhat hesitant to accept information from laboratory results. And I think that attitude has changed dramatically in recent times. And what we are doing in the lab, I think, is becoming more and more relevant to understanding the mechanics of earthquakes. And hopefully I can convince you of some of that today. I should recognize my collaborators at the USGS, Nick Beeler, Brian Kilgore, and Diane Moore, who did the petrographic work and the SEM images that I'll show in my talk, and Greg McClaskey, who gave a talk here this same lecture, I guess, somewhat over a year ago. He was a postdoc working with us for 3 years and now is at Cornell University. So I'll be showing a little bit of his work that he probably, some of the slides may actually look familiar to you if you were around for his lecture. So with that, here is an outline of this. I think there's quite a broad range of people in the familiarity of what they have with the rock physics laboratory research. So I'll try to give you information that something will be interesting to everyone, I hope. But I'll talk a little bit about earthquake recurrence and prediction, maybe. I can say that word here. Then laboratory simulations and laboratory earthquakes, which... if you're not familiar with stick slip, that's what we call earthquakes in the lab. Acoustic emission, stick slip nucleation, magnitude calibrations, spring slider modeling, and the notion of a critical stiffness in these systems. And finally, some experiments we did on frictional heating and surface melting and the energy budget for sliding on laboratory fault surfaces. Okay, so to begin with, this is a plot of an experiment that I did a while ago now. The horizontal axis is the slip on a fault surface. This is granite on granite on a very flat ground surface at 25 MPa confining pressure, which is clamping the fault surface together, and then deforming the sample by advancing a piston against it at a constant rate. And what you see towards the that's blown up in the box here is a series of stick slip. Each one of these stress drops is a stick slip event. And so the idea here is that I don't know that it was a very creative description of what these are, but as you load up the system, the fault is locked and the stress rises until it hits the yield strength of the fault, and then there's a sudden dynamic stress drop accompanied by a loud bang, and the fault locks up again, and then so it slips here and it sticks there, and that was the name that was assigned to these things, and we talk about them that way ever since. So, in terms of a time-predictable earthquake model, back in the 70s, the heady days of earthquake prediction, one of the notions was that the plates are loading up fault systems at a constant rate, and you have a system just like this, you should be able to get repeating earthquakes. And so this, as an example of what happens in the laboratory under the most ideal conditions, and you can see that the peak stress is nearly constant here. The time interval between events is nearly constant. We get a coefficient of variance of about 2%. out of this. And that's absolutely the best you can do in the simplest system that you can have. So if you have a 100-year earthquake repeat time, that means you can predict with this sort of model every plus or minus 2 years, which is not, if we could do that, we'd be really happy. So the Earth is much more complicated than this. So I'll be talking about these, and one other thing to notice here is that the peak stress is evolving here steadily, and the separation time between events is gradually increasing. And this system is, nothing is happening to the loading system. The only thing that's changing in this system is that we had a bare surface granite on granite here, and as we deform it over 10 or 12 millimeters of slip, we're developing a fine powder called rock gouge or rock flour that is coating the surface, ultrafine particles that are changing the properties of the surface. So this is, even in the simplest system, there's an evolution here that has a first order effect on the response of the system. Okay, so here we can apply this to earthquakes. If people remember the Parkfield earthquake experiment, this was back in the 1980s. So the San Andreas Fault runs down through past San Francisco, through Central California, and then down past LA here. Parkfield is a small town on the San Andreas that is right at the transition from the central San Andreas that deforms primarily by creeping and the locked section to the south where the large earthquakes like the Great 1857 earthquake happened. That when you talk to Californians about the next big one, it's a repeat of this 1857 that broke from Parkfield south. So at this time, in the mid-80s, two seismologists from the USGS noticed that at Parkfield, there are repeating magnitude 8 earthquakes that happen on a very regular basis. Since 1857, they've happened at an average of about every 22 years. And here in the mid-80s, they said, oh, well, the last one was in the 60s, and so we're ready for the next event to happen. So the Parkfield prediction experiment was put in place. They instrumented that section of the San Andreas to capture the next earthquake, and the end of the window that they predicted was about 1993. 1993 came and went. The Earth is not as cooperative as one might hope. And in fact, that's in 2004, the event finally did happen. And it was a magnitude 6 earthquake, and it was at Parkfield, but outside the window, time window. So a successful earthquake prediction is time, location, and magnitude. Those are the three elements. We've got 2 out of 3, so it's not a 100% prediction, but reasonable success. But what it did do was that we have some unprecedented records of near-field records of seismology, seismological records, and geodetic records of a moderate-sized earthquake. So in that sense, the Parkfield prediction experiment was a profound success. And this is really about as good as it gets in the natural Earth, that where you can find places where earthquakes will repeat this regularly. So that's most of what I have to say about natural field experiments. The rest of the talk I'm going to devote to the work in the laboratory that we do to try to understand the mechanics of stick slip and earthquake nucleation and other earthquake processes. So it's very hard to study these things in the field because we don't know where to go to capture the next large earthquake, and generally they're happening at depth, so you can't look at them directly. So really we're depending on what we can do in the lab to learn about fundamental issues related to the source mechanics. So we'll start here with work that I have done with Greg McClaskey when he was here, and actually started with Paul Young and his student Ben Thompson, who, as he said, were working in the lab with us. This is my version of a fault surface that produces an earthquake. This is a granite sample, 3-inch diameter. carefully machined and with a saw cut surface inclined 30 degrees to the sample axis. And so that's an idealized fault that most of what I'll talk about is related to in the rest of this talk. Here is a sample pair put together and mounted with a steel forcing block on the end. The brass cans on the sides contain piezoelectric transducers to measure acoustic emission generated during deformation. It acts as a miniature seismic array, so we get first motion and also waveforms from this very dense and very near field miniature seismic array. Here's the sample wired up, ready to go on the pressure vessel. We'll flip it over and load it in the other direction. Just if you haven't been to Ben's lab and seen, to Paul's lab and seen how this works. Here's Greg McClaskey. We're putting the sample into the pressure vessel here. Looking from the side, here's the test machine. It's called a triaxial machine. The pressure vessel here is actually up here. This is, we apply confinement, which is equivalent to burying the sample in the earth. The horizontal stresses in the earth, and then the lower part is a large hydraulic ram, 1,000-ton press, that pushes a piston against the end of the sample to actually cause deformation. So here's a schematic of this with the sample in the pressure vessel. Surrounding the sample is an oil bath that is pressurized, and the fault slides on this 30-degree saw cut here. Okay, so that's the basic idea of what we're doing. Oh, the other thing I should mention is that we have a servo control system on the ram that measures the displacement of a position here outside the pressure vessel. So there's an elastic column, including the rock sample itself, between the control point and the fault. And this becomes important in analyzing the slip response of the system. Okay, so I just want to emphasize here the difference between a stick slip event shown characterized here, in which in red we're showing what part of the surface is slipped, and in terms of stick slip events, the entire surface is involved in the sliding and for a dynamic event. And contrast that to an acoustic emission, which we know the largest acoustic emissions that we get in this geometry are about 5 millimeters, and they go down in size from that. So the boundary conditions for a stick slip event see the free surface of the sample. This boundary condition is not normally what you would consider for a natural occurring earthquake. Essentially, the stiffness of the loading frame is what interacts with the fault surface here to cause the stick slip event. But for an acoustic emission event, you shed stress at the surface that is sliding, and the surrounding region is able to absorb that stress change and arrest the stress. So this is the geometry of very much like an earthquake. And these acoustic emission events, as near as we can tell, cannot be distinguished from naturally occurring earthquakes. So just quickly, talk about two competing models here. Cascade model, where a small patch fails and it just continues to grow rapidly, dynamically. This is like a cascade model. And contrast that to the other type of model that is popular in the earthquake mechanics literature, where you actually have a small patch that fails quasi-statically and grows until it reaches a critical dimension, which then goes unstable and ruptures dynamically. So the pre-earthquake phases of these two are very different. That in the pre-slip model, there's a slow accelerating creep region that lasts minutes or days or weeks. But in the cascade model, you have essentially no warning. And for 9 out of 10 of these events that happen, that 9 out of 10 will be arrested, but 1 will break through and get to the next larger size. nine out of 10 of those will arrest, and only one will break through the next larger size there, and it's all controlled by the surrounding stress field. That's that the rupture, when it initiates, doesn't really know about the surrounding stress field. So then you can imagine, for this pre-slip model, you can characterize the nucleation patch size, critical size, by these parameters, the D and B and A. These are material properties on the fault. Mu is the stiffness of the material, and sigma N is a normal stress. There's been another hybrid model that's been proposed recently that looks at that suggests that there are stiff patches within a tougher, larger patch size, and these can fail, but then get arrested by sliding around their perimeters until they cause the larger patch to fail when it's prepared to fail. And this is a model that's very similar to what we envision is happening with acoustic emissions on these fault surfaces, that each acoustic emission is essentially testing the state of stress on the fault surface. And they keep testing it until one of them finds that the fault is prepared to run away as an unstable event. And the sorts of models that you can imagine that would provide for small, very brittle patches buried on the fault surface would be things like grains breaking that are trapped on the fault surface, or breaking off of high spots, rough spots on the surface, or if there's gouge, that you can have force change that fail. And there are a number of mechanisms that can lead to these localized rapid stress drops that will test the state of stress on the fault surface. So here is a series of seven experiments, stick slips that I did with when Greg McClaskey was working with me. And here's one sequence of acoustic emission that has occurred leading up to one of those stick slip events. They're color-coded. From the dark blues are the early events through to the reds, which are the events happening just before a stick slip, which is indicated by that X there. So most all of the surface is involved in that experiment. Here's another experiment where the early events, there are many fewer acoustic emission events, again leading up to stick slip nucleating as shown here. Now one of the important features of this, of these stick slip events is that the entire fault is actually creeping while the acoustic emission is happening. And so there's background creep that we can observe occurring on the entire fault here at a tenth of a micron per second accelerating into the stick slip event. And here's a second example, again at about a tenth of a micron per second. This is 60 seconds before the stick slip event. And you again see this characteristic accelerating creep leading into the acoustic emission, or into the stick slip event. And the acoustic emission rate is also picking up as we head into the stick slip. I should point out that 98% of the moment release leading up to the stick slip is being taken up as aseismic slip. And the acoustic emissions are very small in terms of the total energy budget. So they're really just going along for the ride and essentially telling you the state of stress on the surface. But most of the action is preparation of the surface by the background slow slip that's going on. Here are two events. One is, this is the main stick slip event here. Five different signals at five different transducers on the sample surface. And here are the signals that you see from an acoustic emission event happening in the same location as the nucleation of the stick slip. One thing to note is that the scale is, there's more than 100 times the amplitude of the stick slip. These are very violent compared to the acoustic emissions that are happening here. If you plot them on the same scale, what you see is that you don't see anything on the acoustic emission if you plot it on the scale of the energy release from the main stick slip. But if we amplify the signal by 25 times, now you're seeing in black the acoustic emission signals are showing up. The main part of the stick slip event is way off scale here, but you're actually seeing information showing up at a very small amplitude on at the leading edge of the main event. These are results that when Paul and Ben were working in the lab with us, we actually first identified these, this observation that the onset of the stick slip event is well locatable and it looks just like an acoustic emission, and it probably is an acoustic emission. Here, we've offset them slightly so you can compare them. Here is the first, well, this is a 50 microsecond time series, and if you look at the first motions of this of the main stick slip event before it goes off scale, it's very similar in character to the acoustic emission event. The acoustic emission event ends after about 5 to 10 microseconds and just rings down because it arrested. But that same event, when the fault surface is prepared for it, actually continues to run away in a cascade type event and takes off into the main stick slip. So it's essentially showing this model that I'm proposing, that the stick slip events are nucleating as acoustic emissions, which are favorably located to actually break out of the local stress field and essentially involve dynamic rupture of the entire surface. Here are the full set of experiments. We did 10 stick slip events at different confining pressures. 9 out of the 10s were locatable in this way, and the work that we did with Paul showed the same result, that there are very precise locations. And the amplitude of these initial acoustic emissions that are the nucleation for stick slip events, they're always large, but some of them aren't even the largest acoustic emission events in the sequence. They just happen to be in the right place at the right time to cascade. And here's an example of naturally occurring earthquakes and their foreshock sequences that show very similar behavior in terms of premonitory, in this case, earthquakes as foreshocks that would be similar to the acoustic emission events we see as foreshocks to a stick slip. Okay, so I'll move on now to the next part of the talk, which is magnitude calibration. I'll just talk about this very briefly. This is something that Greg did with us, that where he noted that if you do a ball drop and apply Hertz theory to it, you find in the frequency spectrum that there is a constant stress. Constant amplitude at the low frequency, and which represents the momentum transfer of the ball to the material, and then there's a corner frequency and a roll off, and this has a similar character to the moment, the scalar moment of an earthquake. And by equating these two, we can do a bootstrap calibration of the system and actually apply a direct quantified moment to the acoustic emissions that we record. We've done this in the calibrating this in the pressure vessel by having a sample that we put a hole in and drop a ball bearing to strike the surface of the sample here and record the signals at a series of transducers to calibrate the system at different confining pressures. So by doing this, we see that Indeed, you see a corner frequency. Here is for stick-slip events. Here are for acoustic emission events of much lower amplitude, but you can actually put a magnitude, moment magnitude scale of minus 6 to minus 3 on this plot and not just look at the amplitude of the waveforms. So acoustic emission events, the largest acoustic emission events that we record are in the minus 6 range. Stick-slip events are minus 3 to minus 4 magnitude. And they're certainly in the studies of mines, they are looking at earthquakes that are in this magnitude range. So this is really an interesting time that we can, in the laboratory, reproduce model earthquakes that are in the same magnitude range of what are observed in natural settings. So we really are reaching an overlap, a time when there is an overlap between the laboratory studies and the field studies. When you do this analysis, you find that these acoustic emission events cannot be, they look indistinguishable from earthquakes. They have corner frequencies. The stress drops are in the same range as what you would find for natural earthquakes, as shown here. Here's a moment plot for large earthquakes, mining, small mine earthquakes, and then the laboratory studies that are falling down here to magnitude minus 6. We know by analogy that we can detect acoustic emissions that are much smaller than this, and if you just continue this plot up, we don't have direct measure of their waveforms calibrated this way, but by analogy that these plots at least go down to magnitude minus 9 for the acoustic emission events. Okay, I'm going to talk now about the spring slider modeling of stick-slip events. And back in the 80s, a group at Harvard have analyzed nonlinear response of a spring slider system, which is the simplest system that you can use to characterize the stick-slip events in the laboratory. Here you just have the fault is represented here by a frictional surface, sliding surface, connected to a load point that oftentimes will just advance at a constant velocity, V0, but it's connected through a spring, which is represented by the elastic properties of the rock and the loading frame. And these are some constitutive equations that are used that are called rate and state equations that represent the stable sliding in terms of the state variable, the velocity, and a characteristic sliding distance over which the state variable evolves, and then empirical material properties A and B that characterize how the fault surface weakens or strengthens as with slip. Using these equations, they did numerical modeling with a two-state variable model that has, what they find is that around a critical stiffness represented here, if the system is stiffer than this critical stiffness, you'll just get stable sliding. And if the stiffness is more compliant, is lower than the critical stiffness, you'll get stick-slip events down here. But for a two-state variable, they find this curious regime where you get a complex response and periodic sliding that evolves as you move farther and farther away from the critical stiffness. This is represented here by their numerical models, where going from the top to bottom, we're going from a stiff system through to from the critical stiffness down to more and more compliant system. And you see that you have decaying oscillations here going into steady oscillations that grow in amplitude as the system becomes more compliant. And then you get more complex behavior like period doubling in here. And finally, the system becomes even more complex and may show signs of going chaotic before you get into the stick-slip behavior when you get to the more compliant part of the system. That's just a blow-up of the previous slide. If you plot this in phase space, where this is log velocity on the horizontal axis and strength stress on the vertical axis, you find that there is a boundary that represents a critical stiffness here, that if you perturb the system and it'll spiral into as an attractor to the steady state sliding strength, which is represented by this solid line, diagonal line. But if you start above the critical state, the system will not recover. It'll just take off and give you stick slip. So go back to this figure. Here we have, as you recall, steady periodic stick slip events. This is a very compliant system. And this is what the surface looks like after this. I've rubbed this with my finger. You can see the very, very fine powder that develops on the surface from shearing. It is this powder that is going to change the properties of the sliding surface. If we change the position of where the system is controlled, the feedback system for controlling the ram, to make the system just 30% more stiff, instead of getting this very uniform stick-slip behavior, now we're seeing oscillatory slip in these patches here that switch to stick-slip here and then back to periodic oscillations and jump back and forth, flip back and forth between stick-slip behavior and oscillatory stress. And this is a property that is certainly not predictable by the simple rate state parameters that have been analyzed so far. And this is just by just this 30% change in stiffness of the loading frame. So here's a blow up of part of this. Here we have, these are steady oscillations. It looks like period doubling here. Again, just like we saw, these are not stick slip events. These are taking a few seconds to weaken, and then you get this very repeatable pattern, which evolves until you get to this point and a stick slip event happens. These are small, very small stick slip, but audible dynamic stick slip events. Later on in the experiment, here we have oscillatory behavior where the oscillations grow, and then they reach a point where we get stick slip, three stick slip cycles, and then it recovers and goes back to periodic oscillations again, and then another episode of stick slip. So this is very, very odd kind of behavior to get in this extremely simple system. So if you wanted to describe these two behaviors, the original steady stick slip would start at the initial part of the experiment here in the stable range, and as gouge was produced on the surface, then it just jumped over here, and all we get are unstable stick slip for the rest of the experiment. But the second experiment is hopping back and forth. Somehow the material properties of the surface are changing, so it hops to this unstable behavior, transitions back over to stable or somewhere in the middle here, and then reverts back to unstable behavior. So that's for such a simple system, that's a very curious kind of behavior to evolve. If you take the same system that is marginally stable, these are decaying oscillations at each point indicated here, I double the sliding rate, and it perturbs the system, which then rings down, and it perturbs it again, and it rings down again. If we plot the phase plot of this, this shows a phase in log velocity stress space. We see the oscillations decaying down like this. This one, we get another one. This is very reminiscent of what they found in their numerical modeling for this nonlinear response of the system. So we're able to recreate a lot of the characteristics that they predict from the very simple spring slider models, and in fact show some behavior that is certainly beyond what the simple models would suggest. Okay, so in the remaining part of the talk, what I'm going to focus on are experiments, a series of stick slip experiments where we actually looked at the frictional heating on the surface and how that's related to the energy budget and the mechanics of the stick slip. So here are samples. These are now smaller. They're 1-inch diameter cylinders, but essentially the same setup. Here I'm holding a sample assembly in my hand with the thermocouple, which the wire comes in here. The thermocouple sits about 2 millimeters away from the sliding fault surface embedded in the granite sliding block. And here are two examples of the stick slip that you observe. Here at 100 MPa confining pressure, we get regular stick slip events shown here. If you go four times higher to 400 MPa confining pressure, the sample is much stronger. And in this case, we see total stress drops. Two stick slip events, much more displacement per slip, and in fact, total stress drops. Where in the lower confining experiments, we see maybe 30 to 50% stress drops. So here is an example of what these surfaces look like. Here's the starting material, 100 micron bar here. This has been ground and lapped with 600 grit abrasive. So we get this very rough surface shown here. This is a 20 micron bar here showing that this very rough surface. When we put two of these surfaces together and start to shear it, all this material gets sheared off and creates a very fine powdered layer that's about 5 to 7 microns thick. So this will be our fault surface in the experiment. If we then run an experiment at 50 MPa confining pressure, this is what the surface looks like when we come out. You see slicks here in the direction of shearing and a lot of powder on the surface. If here at the high magnification, you see that the powder on the surface, the fault gouge, is submicron particle size. It's very fine particle size. If you do the same experiment at 400 MPa confining pressure, you get a very different looking surface. This is glass that is formed on the surface. The frictional sliding has heated up the surface enough to actually melt the surface. You can see vesicles on the surface here. This is degassing into the fault zone. For these sorts of very delicate features, this is a 20 micron bar for scale. For these really delicate features to survive when us taking the sample apart, this has to be happening in an open void on the fault surface. Here's a stepping back. This is what we saw in the preceding slide. This is what the surface looks like at a lower magnification. It's just plated with this thin melt layer. Here's another example. Here's the sliding surface exposed here when we pull the sample apart. These are relics of the upper sample half that have been welded together. And when we pull the sample apart, the surfaces are welded together so that we only see the actual sliding surface in these little windows in between. So we've recently done studies to see just how much restrengthening occurs when the surface is welded together by this melt, and it's a substantial restrengthening that happens. Here's another example. Looks like taffy to me. If you blow up this section, you can see, again, pervasive melt on the sliding surface. In cross-section, Here's the gouge layer here. This is a 20 micron bar. This is less than 10 microns in width. Now, this is the active sliding surface here. Here's a picture where the driving block, this is a biotite grain. You can see kink bands in the biotite up here. The sliding gouge layer is this thin band here, and adjacent to it, we see voids and vesicles that are what we saw in the previous slide. Okay, thanks. These are what we saw in the previous slide. This biotite is heating up enough to degas and release water onto the fault surface. Here's another example of this. All these vesicles here are, again, this is this is a muscovite grain that is showing vesicles lined up here where the muscovite is degassing as it's heating up. This is the width of the shear zone here. Okay, so just wrap up with a couple of slides showing the sort of the overall properties of this of these stick slip events as you change the confining pressure and go to more and more energetic stick slip. So we did a series of 112 stick slip events that are in our catalog here, going from low confining pressure up to the highest confining pressures. I've separated them. The total stress drop events are nearly all at the highest confining pressure. Here is an example of plotting by peak, log peak shear stress, the static stress drop, log static stress drop. So lines of constant stress drop are plot as diagonal lines as shown here. So all of the total stress drop events show here. At the lower confining pressures, we see more like 25 to 30% stress drops, and a lot of scatter in this, but as you go up in confining pressure, these things end up being nearly all total stress drops. We have some idea of the duration of the slip events. So event duration is shown here in milliseconds. So the shortest small events are about a tenth of a millisecond in duration, and some of the largest stick slip events are more like 3/10 of a millisecond. So you can get an average sliding rate of the fault surface from this. And we see that the small events are somewhere in the 2 meters per second average slip speed, going up to the more violent events, which are 10 to 20 meters per second average slip speed during these events. This is a real challenge in a pressure vessel at these short durations to actually do observations of these properties. It's a work in progress for us. I won't spend much time on this slide except to say that this is the equation for a 1D heat flow model for a heat source that can represent the stick slip event. In red is a time history in seconds of the thermocouple response 2 millimeters away from the fault surface. And we see that the peak temperature rise is 1.4 degrees centigrade during this, following the stick slip event. And in black, we've modeled that by matching the total heat production and the event duration, and that's the black curve here. From that, we get a measure of Q, which is the total heat output during the event, and we also can get, if we know that the event duration time, then we can work out the peak temperature, theta, at the end of the stick slip. When you do that, these are the numbers that you come up with. Here again, we're plotting as a function of fault slip. We're plotting the peak calculated temperature from the thermocouple observations. The small stick slip events are down here in the 100 to 400 degree temperature range. But when we get to the total stress drops, we're seeing that the surface heating is getting up above 1,000 degrees. And shown here in blue is the breakdown temperature for biotite. Experiments that where the surface gets above that temperature, it'll start to degas, as we've seen in the slides that I showed in from the SEM images. Here's the feldspar melting temperature, which is the main constituent of the granite that we're testing. So we have a very good agreement between these calculated temperature rise and the observations we have of sliding of melt on the surfaces. And finally, if we look at the total heat production, that's shown in green and in these open squares here. The total energy release we can measure independently, and that's shown up as this solid blue line here. What we find is that for the small events, the two lines are converging, that almost all of the stick slip energy is going into heating the fault surface. But as we go to more and more energetic events, more heat is being produced, but it's not keeping up with the energy release. So the seismic efficiency of these events, more energy, a sizable amount of the energy is being radiated as seismic energy here. And for the small events, we're seeing that they're converging to nearly all of the energy. Very little energy is going to seismic radiation. Almost all of it is going into heating the surface. Okay, so I'm going to end here by just mentioning the directions that we want to go with this. What we're working on very hard right now is to get direct measurements of high speed measurements of fault slip, local measurements. We want to see what happens when you add water to these systems. And finally, we want to look at different rock types and other different loading conditions. So that is it. Thank you. Yeah.
For the stick slip events that you just showed, they're ranging from low to high confinement.
Yeah.
I know you didn't measure them with the emissions, but or with the PTA, so can you give a sense of the magnitude range across like a plot like that?
Magnitude range of what?
Of that event. Like you said, the larger stick slip events were in the -3 to -4 range. Would that kind of be at the upper end of the plot?
Yeah. Those are the most energetic. Those are probably -4 in this geometry, about a -4 magnitude earthquake. When you go to the smaller end of the spectrum, these are turning into very small events. If you go to lower confining pressure, all you get is stable sliding. So they essentially disappear going to zero at the low end. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's that. Yeah. Yeah. This curve is actually done mechanically, just like what you suggested. What we get for these measures of the energy release is measuring the stiffness of the system and looking at the static stress change that happens from before to after, and that's the energy release that we have a very good. The system is rock below its failure strength and steel members that are all elastic. So it's behaving primarily like an elastic system, and that doesn't change. The system tends to get a little bit stiffer as you go up in confining pressure because there are threads on things that get loaded up, so it becomes a little bit stiffer, but we actually calibrate that independently. Yeah.
Do you have a model to explain why the shear stress at failure in your earliest experiment showed what the shear stress at the beginning of the event keeps on growing? You know, this thing at the end of the stress bar, that was a pretty well level shear stress, but at the beginning of the event, the stress
It shows how sensitive these systems are, that before the powder develops and coats the surface, it's a little, the bare rock on rock can't support as much load. So as you damage the surface and make it rougher and put this very fine gouge, which I don't know if you know the mechanics of ball mills, and if you take a granular material and keep grinding it up, there's a minimum particle size you can get to. The particles get stronger and stronger as they get smaller because this. So when you get a really fine powder locking into the surfaces, it gives you higher static strength. And after you develop that gouge layer, then things kind of level out finally.
How big do you think, at the end of this run you were showing, that
these are something in the 5 to 10 micron range, and the powder is submicron in particle size. If you keep going, I run out of, because of the rubber jacket, I can't keep sliding after 10 millimeters, but I can do a trick of actually unloading it and letting it jump back. The jacket will bring it back, and then I can slide it again. So the gouge stays in there, and I can run these multiple times. After two or three times, you actually build up enough powder that it reverts back to stable sliding. You can't get it to stick slip anymore. So as you keep evolving the surface, all these properties keep changing. It's all the properties of the surface that matter. You add water to it, and things become even more complicated.
Yeah. On your graphs, you show the stress dropping after a six-foot event pretty uniformly. But is that?
That is the event. That's the event. It's not after the event. That is the event.
That is the event.
Yeah.
No. Anyway, is that controlled by the loading device, or is that self-controlled inside the surface?
Well, for the stick slip, as opposed to acoustic emissions, there's what happens. The simplest way to think of it is that the loading frame, if you allow the fault surface to slide, then the elastic loading frame will unload at a certain rate, will unload stress at a certain rate per increment of slip. If the fault surface itself weakens faster than that, then there's an imbalance and it runs away and you get dynamic unloading and it keeps accelerating the fault surface until the loading frame has reduced the driving force until it comes back into balance. So it is being driven by the elastic unloading of the frame. The details of that get a little ugly, but that's sort of first pass, that's how it behaves. That spring slider model is a pretty good representation that the loading frame is just a spring that between the load point and the sample.
Yeah.
There's
been in the literature about low frequency oscillations.
Well, you saw some.
Is that, I think, the same thing?
Maybe. This is one way to do it. People that like this kind of constitutive law. If you try to do this like slow earthquakes or harmonic tremor, that non-volcanic tremor that they see at the base of the San Andreas and other, and in the Cascadia at the base of the seismogenic zone, if you try to do that with fluid diffusion, it doesn't work because these things propagate along the fault at a certain rate that it's very hard to propagate fluid across kilometers to make that work. So, I mean, in principle, you could just have high fluid pressure that's escaping along the fault and weakening the fault and make that happen. But it's very hard to make that kind of a model work. So alternately, models like this where the surface is weakening due to the constitutive properties of the surface seem very appealing. And here we are getting these very complicated slow slip oscillatory behaviors that are, you know, if you don't look too carefully at them, they look a lot like slow slip events. Yeah, and certainly. Yes, when you have this on a large fault surface, then there is interaction of the fault. Here, this is just a single patch that's all operating as a unit.
Sure.
So yeah, then that's another complexity that has to be taken into account.
We are going to briefly go to the faculty club after this, so if some of you want a more personal setting to talk to David, that's okay. But if not, can we please thank him again for coming all the way from California?
Thank you.